Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens. So are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Tom Fowler, who is the host of the Spy Cops Info podcast. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
It's all right. Good to be here.
I guess just to begin with, for our listeners in Australia who might not be aware, and I understand this is a bit of a big question, what's a spy cop?
So when we talk about spy cops, essentially it's an undercover police officer, but what we've come to it's going to use it to mean is particularly those undercover officers of Special Branch who were deployed through two units, the Special Demonstration Squad and the National Public Order Intelligence Unit, which... The SDS was set up in 1968, deployed specifically against left-wing, progressive, anti-war, feminist, anti-apartheid, anti-racist, animal rights, environmentalist, socialist, communist, anarchist groups.
And what sort of activities did they pursue within these groups?
Yeah, sure. One of the main reasons why these deployments came to such attention was fairly early on, they decided in order to build their legend, their undercover identity, that rather than using fake names, they would steal the identities of dead children. They would go to St. Catherine's House, which was the repository of the births, deaths, find someone of around the same age who had died as a child, and take not just their name and date of birth, but also then go and spy on the family, work out the life this person would have had, and then combine it with their own story to create their legend of their undercover identity. They call this the Jackal Run because it appears they simply got the idea from the Frederick Forsyth book and film Day of the Jackal. Fairly early on in their deployments, they discovered that the use of female activists, actually women, it didn't really matter if they were an activist or not, but deceiving women into long-term intimate relationships in order to further their legends, to give them greater ability to infiltrate wider networks, and also was to act as a comfort for the undercover officers whilst deployed in these five-year deployments. All these officers were married with children. And it was a prerequisite of being recruited into the unit. It was considered that you needed to have a wife and children in order to have an anchor in the real world because there was a fear that you might go native. But whilst deployed, in some cases, these officers would deceive anything from one to literally hundreds of women into intimate relationships. In some cases, these relationships resulted in children. Obviously, when these men got to the end of their deployments, they disappeared, leaving behind their children. Yeah, the sort of tactics used by the undercover officers were completely illegal under British law. They didn't even have a warrant to enter people's homes, something which they did as a matter of course. We've heard since 2015, there's been a public inquiry into these deployments, and we've heard from lots of these former undercover officers who have been called to give evidence on the stand. They've repeatedly sort of expressed the belief that because they were in the SDS, that normal rules didn't apply. Essentially, that anything they did was legal because of what their position was. Yeah,
Tom, this may seem like a silly question, but can you tell us how many of these men have ended up in prison for their crimes?
Oh, none whatsoever. Some of them got MBEs. Most of them were promoted, had very glittering careers. They went on to hold very high positions of office within the police. One of them went on into private industry. Some, because they were Special Branch, most of them were rotated around different roles. So it was very common for former undercover officers to then become close security for leading politicians. Some went on to be the personal bodyguard of Tony Blair. Some went on to set up things like Special Branch Baghdad in the aftermath of the Iraq War. Others ended up as head of police intelligence for the Metropolitan Police, as corporate security experts. One officer, Jim Boyling, actually, who was giving evidence next week at the inquiry, did end up losing his job as a police officer. He's the only example. It's unusual. We're not really sure why. And hopefully we'll be able to answer that question next week with his question at the inquiry.
And in terms of who these men were they your typical police officer? Was there anything that distinguished them that enabled them to undertake these roles?
They were already political police. So they're obviously, undercover policing is a regular tactic used by police in criminal cases. But these units weren't governed by the same set of policing infrastructure that exists around criminal undercover work. In criminal undercover work, you send somebody into some sort of drug gang or something. They build a case, a prosecution is brought out, and then that undercover officer, though his identity might be protected in court, gives evidence, and everybody who's kind of gets caught, and they're like, oh, that was the undercover cop. In these cases, they weren't doing anything like that. There was no evidential basis to their deployments. It was purely intelligence-led. They were already special branch officers. They'd been working behind the scenes in desk roles or in observational roles, targeting political activity, political extremism, as they would call it. And so their recruitment then to become what was known as a deep diver as opposed to a shallow swimmer. So it's quite common for special branch to use plainclothes officers who might attend demonstrations, might go to public meetings. These officers wouldn't necessarily have built up any sort of fake identity as such. They wouldn't necessarily be looking to speak to anybody whilst they go to these things. But then from those officers, they recruited, there was a tap on the shoulder, and it was considered very prestigious as the highest kind of rank within special branch. They were the best paid police officers in Britain by some distance because they were living in these roles. Not completely full-time. Generally, they would have a cover job with their deployment. So they would tell the women that they were deceiving, that they were off to work, and then they would go home to their wife and children for between the hours of 7 a.m. and 5 p.m. But yeah, so they were already political police before they became undercover police.
Tom, it's extraordinary measures and an extraordinary amount of resources being deployed. I assume then that they uncovered quite a lot of political extremism. What are some examples of the dastardly acts that they prevented?
So the initial deployment, the initial reason for the existence of the unit was in relation to the anti-Vietnam War campaign. There was a very famous demonstration in March 1968 against the Vietnam War in the UK. The police lost control of that demonstration in Grosvenor Square outside the US Embassy. The next day, a senior police officer, Conrad Dixon, had a meeting with the Home Office and various other important members of the government and said that, give me 10 good men, £500,000 a year, and this will never happen again. And that was the formation of the Special Demonstration Squad. That may be apocryphal. It's what he wrote in his own obituary for the Times for the existence of the unit. All these undercover officers were very keen on taking control of the narrative, as you can imagine. But the initial success was to stop the second national demonstration against the Vietnam War from being a confrontation. They sent 10 undercover officers into local branches. When the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign ad hoc committee had a large meeting in order to decide where the second demonstration would take place, it was agreed by a very close vote, all 10 undercover officers voted in this vote, to have that demonstration in Hyde Park, away from any sort of flashpoint, as a show of strength, not to have a confrontation. This was considered a great success and led to the unit continuing to exist. From then on, it's really how you measure it. Certainly, so one of the organisations they infiltrated was the Troops Out Movement, which was a campaign not to have British soldiers deployed on the streets of Britain, specifically in relation to Northern Ireland, Ulster, the occupied six counties. They sent an undercover officer into that. In the area in which he was based, there wasn't a local branch, so he set one up. He deceived two women into intimate relationships, which seemed to get him into a position of trust. He ended up being the London coordinator. Eventually, he ended up as the national secretary of the Troops Out movement. So from a police point of view, they managed to take control of what they would consider a politically extremist organization. I should say, despite what some of right-wing commentators would say at the time, the Troops Out movement wasn't an Irish Republican organization. A lot of the more high-profile members were priests that had cross-party support amongst various MPs. It was considered a fairly neutral position. It had popular support. Most people didn't agree that sending troops onto the streets of Britain was a good idea at the time. You can compare that similarly with the Vietnam War, anti-Vietnam War campaign. Most people in Britain didn't think that British troops should be deployed. And in the end, they weren't, which I think is a great success to the anti-Vietnam War movement in this country. But yeah, there were particular sort of deployments that got a lot of attention within the unit and were held up as great successes, particularly Bob Lambert, who infiltrated London Greenpeace, animal rights groups in the 1980s. He deceived four women into intimate relationships. He had a child with Jackie, one of the animal rights activists who he infiltrated. Whilst he was in London Greenpeace, he co-authored a leaflet, What's Wrong with McDonald's, which led to the McLibel, the longest case in British legal history, where the McDonald's Corporation sued the activists, and only two of them refused to back down, Dave Morris and Helen Steele. Whilst he was deployed, he set up his own cell of the Animal Liberation Front, essentially as a means of being trusted by other cells, was the kind of the idea. That cell planted incendiary devices in branches of Debenhams department store in the fur departments. One of the places they planted these incendiary devices, the sprinkler system, the idea was you'd set off these quite small sort of incendiary devices, they would create a lot of smoke, that would set off the sprinkler system, it would ruin the fur coats. In one of the branches, the sprinkler system didn't go off. It was faulty. It burnt down the department store, costing many millions pounds worth of damage. Bob Lambert managed to avoid being held responsible for that. He went on to get an OBE, went on to head the unit, had a very glittering career as an academic. He set up the Muslim Contact Unit. He was involved with Prevent, all sorts of community tension teams, quite influential within British policing. His deployment was considered a success by their metrics, at least.
Tom, absent this arson and presumably other similar incidents, much of the spying appears to be essentially political in the sense that it's not concerned with criminal activity. Mm. Many of the groups that were spied upon were engaged in lawful activity. How has this played out in the inquiry, this question of what is the basis for these sorts of incredibly intrusive forms of police surveillance?
In terms of proportionality, so as far as the inquiry has gone so far, we had an interim report after tranche one of the inquiry, which was looking at deployments in the late 60s and 70s. That concluded that there was no justification for the deployment of the unit. The unit should have been wound up after that initial anti-Vietnam War demonstration was averted from being a confrontation. Because of the nature of the way these inquiries work, we await another interim report, which may come out next year. We're 11 years into the inquiry at this point. What we see day in, day out at the inquiry is the questioning of witnesses, either undercover officers or civilians who were spied upon. Civilians who are spied upon generally have to undergo a great deal of questioning about their own attitudes towards violence, towards lawbreaking. We saw just the other day Roger Geffen, MBE, a very celebrated activist for cycling in the UK, who was questioned 12 times about his attitudes towards violence, something which he dismissed within the first 3 minutes of his questioning, explaining himself to be a pacifist, somebody who'd been arrested many times, nothing for anything ever coming in near violence. 4 hours later, he's still on the stand being asked about his attitudes towards violence. That's because when the undercover officers come to give evidence, they talk about serious criminality of the groups they infiltrated. We've yet to see any evidence of that kind of level of violence. And certainly, whenever undercover police have found themselves in a situation where there was something a bit more serious going on, they were withdrawn. So in the 1970s, there was Peter Fredericks, who was infiltrating a very small left-wing group, one of the many versions of the Workers' Revolutionary Party, not the current one. But he splintered from that group, set as his own group, as seemed to be the sort of thing that they would do. He was approached by someone from the Soviet embassy. He reported this back to his managers, and they were like, withdraw, that's far too dangerous. Nothing too dangerous, get out of that. These officers were not, their job wasn't to target terrorism. They were specifically about infiltrating groups that stand in the road and hold banners and placards. That was who they were deployed against. We see in their reports claims that people are violent, claims that that certain individuals are involved in criminality. No evidence of that, though, is ever produced. Sometimes the officers claim that, oh, this person was violent, and they give some sort of reasoning for that. But there's no sign of it in any of their reports from the time. They didn't report it at the time. It appears to be something that they try now and rely on once they've been caught out for their wrongdoing.
Tom, were any of these officers discovered at the time of their deployment? And I guess, how did this kind of, these 50 years of political spying, how did it begin to unravel? What exposed all this activity?
The exposure happened in 2010. There were times in the past where undercover officers did get exposed by activists. Back in the 1970s, Rick Clark, the officer who ended up as National Secretary of the Troops Out movement, he was exposed by activists within Big Flame, who did a great deal of research into him and presented him with his own death certificate. I mean, he managed to get out of that situation. They withdrew him. Members of Big Flame were terrified by the experience. They wrote a dossier. They tried to get it to a journalist. And nobody would touch it. This incident never really got any kind of further traction. It was only really... when Helen Steele, who was one of Libel 2, set up essentially by Bob Lambert, she was also deceived into a long-term intimate relationship by another undercover officer, John Dines. John Dines, actually, who works these days in Australia teaching police ethics, says it all, really. When he disappeared, she did a lot of research, tried to find him. Initially motivated out of genuine concern, these undercover officers, with their exfiltration strategies, heavily used trauma as a means of covering their tracks. And out of great concern for him and his mental well-being, she desperately tried to find him. She came to the conclusion that he was an undercover police officer, traveled across the world, went to New Zealand, to Australia. She eventually did track him down, by which point the unit was fully exposed. But she spent decades doing that. And whenever there was a rumor of somebody else who believed that their ex-partner had disappeared and was an activist, may have been an undercover police officer, she tracked them down. And it was a group of the women who were deceived into these relationships who did so much of the detective work in piecing this stuff together. They've written a book, Deep Deception. It's now the subject of an ITV documentary, Undercover Love and Lies Exposed, that tells the stories of the women doing that. But it was in 2010, Mark Kennedy, who deceived a woman who we refer to as Lisa to protect her identity, was exposed by her after she found... Basically, he'd been undercover for 7 years at this point. The police, he was only a member of the police for the first five. When it came to time for him to be withdrawn, he didn't want to. He didn't want to leave this life. It seemed to be quite a common thing amongst undercover officers that they preferred their life undercover to their real lives. So he continued as a private investigator, selling information to corporate interests. As such, he didn't have the backup of the police that most undercover officers have, and got sloppy, essentially, with his tradecraft. She found a passport that in his real name. She confronted him about it. He did a whole bunch of bullshit lies and essentially attempted to have a nervous breakdown in front of her in order to hide the fact. He came up with a ridiculous story. But in the fullness of time, they got to the decision that, yeah, he was an undercover officer. They confronted him about it at a meeting, which he left from. That went public. This led to a number of journalists, Rob Evans and Paul Lewis at The Guardian, running stories about it, trying to get in contact with other people who had similar stories. For example, my own group in South Wales Anarchists got in touch about somebody who had been a part of our group who disappeared or moved abroad some year or so earlier. And they were able to take the police and say, we're going to run this on the front page. The police were like, don't do that. These officers are deployed elsewhere. Give us 3 days to withdraw them before you run these stories. Which kind of gave the confirmation for it. And yeah, kind of started the dominoes falling around this unit. It was when it was exposed that the family of Stephen Lawrence was a black teenager who was murdered in a racist attack, whose family spent many decades trying to get the police to do their jobs and hold the killers to account. But it was found out that they had been infiltrated, and it turned out that pretty much any family campaign for justice after a racist murder or in police custody were also being spied on by undercover officers. That's what led to the public inquiry being called. Also, an undercover officer, Peter Francis, one of the undercover officers, went whistleblower in 2009. And he was reading that his interview in The Observer, where he explained the method of a five-year deployment, the withdrawal method, the exfiltration strategy, the use of trauma, that alerted so many people that their suspicions might be correct. And that kind of, it all came together, really.
Tom, the inquiry's been going for over 10 years now. Why has it gone on so long?
The first 5 years of the inquiry, so it was called in 2014, started in 2015, and we just had pre-inquiry hearings for 5 years. Largely, that was due to the fact that the undercover police were desperately trying to get anonymity. It was very successful in the majority of undercover officers. We still don't know their real names. We don't even know their cover names. So there are a great many people who were affected by the deployment of undercover officers who still have no idea, because though we know that there was HN116 who was deployed at a certain time period, we don't know who that officer was. So we weren't able to kind of cross-reference against contemporaneous photographs to get in touch with people who were around at the time. They brought a number of judicial reviews. This slowed down the process immensely. The disclosure of the police files. The police said, oh, we've destroyed all the files. There aren't any of the files. As it turns out, because they were sending all these files on to MI5, MI5 would get copies. And actually, MI5, weirdly, was much more willing to cooperate with the inquiry than the police were. So we got the majority of those files, which I'm afraid ran out in about 1996 because they stopped sending their files to MI5 at that point. So the redaction process, it requires, I think it's 8 pairs of eyes need to go through and redact these documents. In lots of cases, we get in these reports and they're just all black boxes. We do get some information, but there's a great deal that is redacted. That whole process slows the whole thing down immensely.
Tom, obviously this behaviour, deceitful behaviour that's in some cases resulted in children is horribly abusive. Can you talk or just speak a little more about the impact that this kind of predation has had and what are the demands being made to hold these men and the institution accountable for its actions?
In terms of the emotional impact, I don't think you can't overstate it really. It's absolutely debilitating. So for some of the people affected, some of the women affected by these long-term relationships, particularly those that resulted in children, it has totally upended their lives. But in a lot of cases, in some ways, it's the women who didn't have children, who spent their most fertile years, as they put it, in relationships with these men, didn't have children, would have loved to have had children, didn't end up having children due to the way that their trust issues have been totally destroyed. They never ended up having a relationship that resulted in children. In some cases, they were lucky enough to, but others they didn't. I don't want to get too specific about the psychological damage on the women because these are my comrades, friends. They speak for themselves. I really would recommend people check out Deep Deception. A few Police Spies Out of Lives is the campaign group and support group of the women. They have a website. I recommend reading their stories, which are on there. But incredibly significant. And also to say those people who didn't have sexual relationships with undercover officers are often very heavily damaged by that experience as well. These people were often considered close friends. There's a mixture with these undercover officers. Some didn't manage to make close personal connections with people. Others very much did and were very well liked. The most successful ones were well liked. That's just the nature of this kind of work. That's had a huge psychological impact on the ability of people, not just to engage in political activity, which obviously has been enormously damaged, but also just to maintain personal relationships. In terms of the demands, we demand the release of the cover names. I would add the real names as well, but the demand is for the cover names. We believe that people should be able to see their files. All the work of these undercover officers was to update the registry files, which are held on people of interest. These files remain secret, and none of us have been able to see any of them. We just get those twice weekly reports that they were submitting, which I have then heavily redacted. So there's a request for that. We also, there's a call by Police Spies Out of Lives for a change in the law to make sex by deception an offence, to prevent the use of sex as a tool of undercover policing. Because though it's being denied, it's very clear, and we see it in the SDS Tradecraft Manual, that the use of sex was a key part of the tools that undercover police used as part of their deployments and part of their infiltration.
Tom, this demand for a change in the legislation, there have been some changes to UK legislation around undercover policing, particularly that I understand that police are absolved of all criminal responsibility for things that they do while undercover.
Yeah, so the Covert Human Intelligence Sources brackets Criminal Conduct Act of 2022, which was brought in by the Conservative government, but with the support of the Labour Party, which had recently been taken over by Keir Starmer, the current Prime Minister. This puts a legislative footing on the whole deployment of both undercover officers and other agents of the state, the CHIS, Covert Human Intelligence Sources. This allows anybody who is employed as an agent of the state to break any law, including torture, rape, murder, if it is in the furtherance of what the state's asking them to do. This is something which, in theory, the idea of a public inquiry is that the public inquiry should conclude before the government legislates on such matters. Obviously, we have no constitution in this country and the government can do as it likes. The fact that the Labour Party, whilst in opposition, didn't oppose this bill, in fact, did a three-line whip to vote for it. It reprimanded its MPs who voted against it. This was part of a wider kind of war on the left by the then new leadership of the Labour Party. Yeah, essentially, things are objectively worse. I think it's fair to say that when it comes to all forms of policing of protest in the UK, things are objectively worse across the board.
Tom, in terms of your own reportage, what kinds of limits are there on what you can? Because I understand you're attending the hearings, you're reporting almost live.
Yeah.
What's been your experience to be present in court during the hearings, and what are the limitations on your own kind of ability to convey to the public what's going on?
Yeah, I must stress, I didn't intend to become some sort of journalist or something. Essentially, I was one of the first people to bring civil litigation against the police for the deployment of undercover officers alongside two of my comrades in South Wales, who were both women who were deceived into intimate relationships. We brought a case at the same time as 8 of the women from around the country who brought a case. And we found ourselves in court, mostly in pre-hearing. It took 7 years in that civil litigation. And I'm very much someone who turns up for things. And I found myself in court with nothing really to do. Once you've had that initial meeting with your lawyer, you sit at the back of the room whilst the legal process plays out. Every hour or two, someone asks you a question, which you then have to relay through a paralegal back to your solicitor who relays it to your barrister. And I was sat in court with nothing really to do. So I started using Twitter to report on what was being said, because we were discovering little tidbits of information. I carried on. I did that both at my own hearings and any hearing to do with undercover policing. When the public inquiry was called, I continued to do that. As there's been a general lack of interest from mainstream media publications, I've expanded that to like doing videos and podcast recordings, doing interviews and chats with people who were also affected, academics, activists, lawyers, so on. In terms of the process at the hearing, there are numerous restriction orders. There is obviously the initial redaction of information, which is not in the public domain in any sense. There's a large amount of information that is I do get to know that I'm not allowed to report. And then there are breaches, slip-ups, where a witness says something that we're not meant to know. When a state witness says something we're not meant to know, the broadcast is paused, and the offending information is expunged from the transcript. In order to hide what that particular thing that was erroneous that was said, they remove information either side of that piece of information so that you're not sure which piece of information was secret. It's incredibly obvious to anybody who's got any understanding of these things what the secret thing was. So I have got in trouble a number of times for reporting not the secret information, but some of the information around it, which, because of the fast nature of my coverage, I cover everything in as close to real time as I'm allowed to. There's a 10-minute delay on proceedings. I have reported things which were inside the restricted time bracket, which are not secret information, but I've fallen foul of the inquiry on a number of occasions. I'm now on my final warning in terms of my coverage. So there is a possibility I will not be allowed to do this any longer at some point. I'm doing my best to try and stay on the right side of all that. But because of the nature of these things, that's quite a difficult process. In terms of the hearings themselves, a lot of them take place audio only. Often the witness joins via video link. Sometimes there's a voice modulation put on to the evidence being given by a former undercover officer. All things which make the process a bit more difficult to follow. But yeah, I continue to try and do my best with it.
Tom, this practice has apparently stopped, or the inquiry covers up to a certain point in time. What's your understanding of what the current situation is? Obviously, if legislation is being brought in to allow impunity for undercover human sources, that perhaps there's still some of this going on. But what's happening with spy cops in the here and now?
Yeah, so there's no suggestion that these sort of tactics have been stopped. So what has ended is the existence of the units in question. So the Special Demonstration Squad was wound up in 2007, 2008. The National Public Order Intelligence Unit was merged into SO15, Counterterrorism Command, in 2010. So the specific units are the ones that have ended. In terms of the practice, I think the world has changed, right? Just from a technical point of view, it's a lot more difficult to send someone out into the world without them having some sort of footprint because of the nature of social media and all these kind of things. We're also much more hyper-connected now. It's a lot harder for people to disappear. It's almost certain they're using different sorts of tactics. We know that the use of infiltrators, professional infiltrators, has grown exponentially in criminal cases. We believe that's the case with political policing as well. Certainly the legislation, the way that it's written, allows for the use of private investigators, private infiltrators. We live in an age of neoliberal policing. The British police employ all sorts of other companies to do lots of different roles that the police traditionally did. We believe that infiltration is no different. So it may be the case that there are infiltrators in groups. And we've seen examples throughout this process of informers, infiltrators, grasses, people who've been turned inside groups, people who are who they say they are, people who go into the groups are who they say they are, but doing it in order to elicit information out of people and pass them on to the authorities. So that area is massive. So it's not necessarily an undercover cop in a group, but it's someone working for the police. We also, there's the huge rise in surveillance technology now, which has obviously always been deployed by the cops, as they've been on the cutting edge of that for a long time. the ability now for the police to use CCTV, mobile phones, electronic surveillance of all different kinds in order to track people in real time has grown exponentially. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about this. People imagine it in terms of like algorithms or something. We know that huge numbers of police are employed at desk in desk-based roles, following people in real time, using backdoors into people's phones at the same time as using like CCTV technology and number plate recognition and everything else. So it may be the case that there is an undercover officer within a group. He's not physically there. He's working from a desk elsewhere. He's calling on the information from infiltrators and informers, as well as from cameras, both covertly displayed and overtly displayed, as well as backdoors into people's phones in order to monitor things closely. I would say as well, though, because of other legislation changes, we've got a situation in the UK now where people can be sent to prison and have been sent to prison for many years for simply taking part in a Zoom meeting, something which wouldn't have been the case in the past when the SDS was at their height. There's no need for the sort of the entrapment, which was a hallmark of their sort of approach, because you can take people out quite legally through other means.
Tom, two final questions, one about the past and the other the future. First, how successful do you think, based on your own observation, how successful were the spy cops in disrupting various forms of political activism in the UK? And secondly, having knowledge of this history, what lessons do you think can be drawn from these activities, and how do you think political groups and social movements can better respond to future police disruption?
I think in terms of how successful they were, so supposedly the twin aims of the SDS were preventing public disorder and countering subversion. But the reality is there was a third one, which was to discredit, destabilize and destroy social movements. The vast majority of the organizations that these undercover police infiltrated now no longer exist, or if they do continue to exist in a very truncated form. By that metric alone, they were incredibly successful. Huge numbers of people have been intimidated out of taking a political action. I think they did not prevent a great number of phenomenal, inspiring actions from taking place, campaigns from winning their aims. Like, there were no troops put on the ground in Vietnam from the UK. Apartheid South Africa did fall, despite the best efforts of the British state to prop it up. There are no longer troops on the streets of Northern Ireland. There are all sorts of campaigns that were very successful, despite the actions of the undercover police. But in terms of the long-term aims, I mean, certainly when we look at the way in which the environmental movement, the campaigns against climate change were heavily infiltrated, destabilized and destroyed, they were very successful in preventing serious action ever being taken against the root causes of climate change, which, I mean, essentially, as the world gets hotter and we all feel the effects of it, we all feel the successes of the undercover deployments as flooding and heat waves kind of get worse and worse. In terms of what we can learn, I think people did achieve incredible things despite the undercover police. I think the most effective way we can fight back against these things is for people to continue doing, to stay focused on the campaigns they're involved with. I think I'm always asked a lot of questions about how you could spot an undercover officer or ways of excluding undercover police from your campaign. I don't have any good answers for that, but I do have this. It's not something that only undercover police do, but certainly all the undercover police did it, which was to engage in talking about gossip and scandal. We see a lot in the police reports about divisions that existed within groups, and the undercover officers worked hard to push a wedge between people in order to split groups apart, to elevate personal disagreements and claim that they were political ones, to introduce purity tests that activists could like use to exclude each other, to call each other out for not having the right particular political line. As I say, this is not something that's limited to undercover police. Lots of perfectly real activists do this. And I think it's something which destabilizes our movements more than anything else. The police love it. I'm sure that a lot of the online discourse around this sort of thing is fueled by bad actors, people who are using wedge issues in order to undermine social movements. And I would say that the most effective thing people can do to keep their campaign organization safe is to not engage in that kind of gossip, scandal and disagreement, and elevating personal disagreements and claiming that they're political ones, introducing purity tests and all that kind of stuff.
Unfortunately, no good if you love drama like me.
Yeah, and they did. They really did love drama. Michael Jacobs, the undercover officer who was infiltrated South Wales anarchists, when you hadn't seen him for a bit, his first thing he'd say was, any gossip or scandal? We hear a lot about the undercover officers with those activists that they developed matehood with, using a lot of their time to slag off, to take the piss out of other activists, to deride their lifestyle choices, to make out that they were not serious people, to like just rolling their eyes at the... Obviously, when you're involved in political activism, there are moments of high farce, like just accentuating those, highlighting them and making out that people are idiots, people are stupid, people are dirty, all this kind of stuff. I get that all that kind of thing is attractive to us. We're only human, that the soap opera of these things does spark something in our minds that we're interested in it. But I think that has done more to undermine, that is the most successful thing the undercover cops did by their own metrics. And yeah, I would really, as much as attractive as it might be, I would say refraining from that sort of behavior is the best defense against undercover policing.
On that note, we'll leave it there. Tom, thanks so much for joining us. If people want to find out more, you have a podcast, the Spy Cops Info podcast, and people can follow your tweets at Tom B. Fowler. That is if you don't get kicked out of court for tweeting non-secret secrets, or secret non-secrets, I should say. Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, cheers for having me. You can find everything at spycops.info. And if you look up the hashtag spycops on any social media, you'll find the latest stuff.
Andy, that is our program. Just a reminder, it is a subscriber drive at 3CR for the next little bit. So if you are interested in hearing more stuff like this, you can support the station by subscribing. Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe to find out more. We'll see you next week.
Please do. We appreciate it. Yes, we'll see you next week.
Did you know that 3CR first went to air in 1976? That's right. We're turning 50 this year.
Right from the start, we prioritized progressive voices, First Nations issues, local music, alternative perspectives, and truth-telling.
50 years on, it's clear that independent, local media continues to be vital and that there's a strong need for media that shines a light on injustice and gives voice to a vision for a better world.
Are you a current subscriber? We really need you. Subscribe today and help us celebrate 50 years on air.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 03 9419 8377.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.